Welcome to Two Ways Street. Steve Oney has devoted his career to writing magazine essays. It seems to me that in some ways that's humbling work. With the exception of a few stars like Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson, magazine writers rarely receive the acclaim that comes to the hot new literary author whose novel makes the cover of the New York Review of Books. And they don't get the thrill of having legions of fans line up at local bookstores waiting to get an autographed copy of their latest work. Those are the kind of people who Oney profiles. Still, Steve Oney is a master of his craft. Esquire calls him one of the finest practitioners of magazine journalism in the country. His new book is a collection of 20 profiles of men he wrote about at different stages in his career and theirs. As we sat in the Two Way Street studio and talked about some of the men in the book, I realized that Steve's quest to understand himself through the men he's profiled is a compelling story in its own right. Steve Oney, your book is A Man's World, Portraits, a Gallery of Fighters, Creators, Actors, and Desperados. I've been looking forward to having you in for quite some time, Steve. Thanks for being here for Two Way Street.
Thanks, Bill. I'm delighted.
Before we talk about the book, you now live, I think, in the Hollywood Hills, don't you? And
yes.
Have for quite some time.
Yes, for 15 years.
But with that in mind, let's establish your Georgia credentials. You grew up in Atlanta. You're an Atlanta boy.
I was not born here. I cannot answer the question, where did your daddy hunt? Effectively, he hunted someplace else. But I went to high school in Atlanta, Peachtree High School, now defunct, out in DeKalb County, and I attended the University of Georgia as a journalism student.
I think you've said in an essay that you wrote some time ago that at the time, coming out of Peachtree High School, going to the University of Georgia was kind of a consolation prize. You described it in an article as everybody wanted to go to Emory, and if you couldn't get in there, you went to UGA.
At the time, Playboy had an annual back to college issue, and there would always be a full page on party schools, and they would be ranked. And at the bottom of the page, there would be an asterisk, and it would list the University of Georgia ineligible because they're professionals. And even though this was the early 1970s, and a vestige of the counterculture was still in place in Athens, it was a big old-fashioned Southern party school. It was fraternities, sororities, it was Old South every spring, where the KAs and the SAEs would put on Confederate uniforms and march down the street with their dates. And I really wasn't that big a part of it. I worked for the Student Literary Magazine, and which was strange in its own right.
And Impressions?
The Impression, the Georgia Impression. How's that for a great college magazine name? Embarrassing, but we ran some great stuff. It was the heyday of the new journalism, the heyday of Tom Wolfe and Gay Talese and Joan Didion and John McPhee. And I was reading everything I could by all of those people and more. And then I was trying to put it in practice in the little quarterly University of Georgia magazine.
What do you mean for listeners? Because we haven't talked about the new journalism the way we used to. What was it in that style of writing that attracted you back then? And the reason I ask this is because this is all part of the formative years in which you were thinking about the kind of pieces you were going to be writing and the essays that have made you one of the most respected essayists in the country.
It was the stylishness of the writing, the ability to use novelistic tools in nonfiction to create scenes, to write flashbacks, to introduce characters, to describe what people looked like and how they acted. Hemingway once said that every piece of good writing has to answer just one question: what was the weather like? And he meant that figuratively. And new journalism was trying to answer that question with very factual reporting. So when Tom Wolfe would describe the crowd at a stock car race, or the party at Leonard Bernstein's house with the Black Panthers, which he so famously sent up in Radical Chic, those descriptions were based on his incredible research. He would be there every moment taking notes, blending into the background, and absorbing all that he saw and heard so he could come back and give you a accurate account that had all the details and made you feel like you were there with the gossip and the heat and the what people were drinking and smoking. Another writer I much revered during that period, Nora Ephron, she said that a writer should be a wallflower at the orgy. You want to be invited. You want to be where the heat and the action are, but you're a writer, so you're there taking notes. You're not participating. And I just found that to be very, very alluring. I was in a, and it was an answer to my academic dilemma. I was by nature an English major, but I didn't see how I could ever make a living teaching English, and I didn't want to teach. But I also didn't want to be Johnny Deadline. I didn't want to work on a daily newspaper pounding out pieces. I wanted to find what I thought was the middle ground, and magazine writing was the middle ground for me.
Let's talk about A Man's World. Let's start with the title. We are living in a time when we are incredibly aware of the justifiable and important effort that women are making to find their place in the world, to assert themselves, and it's something that occupies a lot of space in conversation these days. And here you come along with a book that declares it's a man's world. Is that meant to be provocative? Is it meant to be a statement in which you say, no, it is a man's world? Where did that title come from?
The title most directly came from James Brown's song, It's a Man's World. Now, if you know you're James Brown, you know very high up in the lyrics comes the line, but it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. So let's state that up front. But the title is meant to be provocative. And I've written maybe 150, 200 magazine stories in my 40 years. And I'm exhausted to even say that number. But a lot of those pieces have been profiles of men. A lot of them have been profiles of women, too. But as I was discussing the possibility of doing a collection of my work with my agent, Beth Vassell, she said, it would be a lot edgier if you just do profiles of men. And if you try to grapple in an introduction with what it is to be a man, what does it take? What did you have to grapple with as you tried to become a man? And that interested me intellectually because unconsciously I had been pursuing that subject by writing these stories. And I realized at a certain point when I was working at the Atlanta Journal and Constitution magazine, maybe it was 1978 or 79, that there'd been a period of 16 months where I might have written 12 profiles of men. And I thought, what am I doing? And I didn't answer the question directly, but it dawned on me that I was trying to learn how to be a man. I was watching men, interesting men, some of them admirable, some of them screw-ups, trying to glean how they did it.
Yeah, you tell us, my father, you say, didn't teach me to be a man. I read that sentence and I thought, gee, my father didn't teach me what it meant to be a man either. But then the second thought I had was, I'm not quite sure even what it would mean to be taught to be a man.
I'm not sure what it means either. And, you know, I'm old school. The battle over definition of manhood and gender and identity has moved far beyond what I'm dealing with here. People are now questioning even the concept of gender, and they believe it's mutable. I don't, but I do think that the issues one needs to contend with to be an effective man are pressing and should be addressed. How do you protect yourself? How do you really defend yourself? Not just with your fists, but in the kind of situations you're going to confront in life. How do you live a creative life? I happen to be a writer, so I work in a creative business, but I think all work is creative. If you're bagging groceries or digging sewers. There's a component of using your imagination. It's not just putting one foot ahead of the other. And how do you act? I've got a section in the book on acting, and it's profiles of actors, but I'm speaking figuratively. How do we present ourselves? And I didn't get that from my dad. I got from my dad a sense of decency and a work ethic and, I hope, kindness and consideration for other people. My dad was incredibly fair-minded. He was a salesman, but he would talk about concepts like fair profit. What's a fair profit? And he would be worried by overcharging or taking advantage of a customer. He was an extremely ethical guy, and all of that was factory installed for me. What I had to learn, what he didn't show me, was what do you do when somebody screws you over? Or how do you keep from getting screwed over? How do you protect yourself in a office or in a corporate environment? And how do you present yourself to the world? And I mean, on the most literal level, it'd be, you know, how do you tie a bow tie, or how do you, you know, get fitted for a tux? But I'm, again, speaking more figuratively.
Here's what you say about what you learned in writing profiles of all these exceptional people. Men must be adept at fighting. You tell us at one point in the book, the first thing you see in the morning when you sit down at your computer is a Post-it note tacked to the bottom of your screen, and on it, you had scrawled something that Herschel Walker told you.
Every day, I've got to get up and fight. And Herschel told me this at age 50. And I wrote a profile of Herschel for Playboy when he got involved in mixed martial arts fighting. And Herschel has pushed himself into so many unbelievable challenges in his life. So on one level, that statement is about being a mixed martial arts fighter, but it's really not. Herschel Walker, even the great Herschel Walker, has to get up every day and put on his game face and say, I'm going to accomplish something in my day. And I'm not going to crawl under the desk. I'm not going to fold my hand. I may not have been dealt the best hand today, but I'm going to play the cards I have today as best I can.
Okay, so in the section of essays that you've put together around fighters, you say this: by fighting, I'm not talking about fisticuffs. No, by fighting, I'm talking about part of the male psyche that seems to demand some form of conflict. A man's world revolves around conflict with others and himself. I wasn't sure I knew how to relate to that observation. You do believe that men have a different sense of, is it a competitiveness in the world? How do you view that in your day-to-day life?
Well, I'm a writer, and I sit alone in a room by myself. maybe I need to get an encounter bat and swing it against the wall.
Are we by nature fighters, men?
Yes, I think so.
In what way?
I think we push ourselves. I think we push others. I think life is a competition. Now, conversely, I'm a believer in teamwork. I come out of really the world of sports and don't believe in being a prima donna. I think you hit the cutoff man in baseball and you throw the extra pass in basketball. And I accept all that stuff philosophically. But I think the world is hard. And I think we fight on some level for every advantage. And I think we kid ourselves to say that there's going to be a place made for us. I think we make our own place.
I relate to that, and I bet you do too. I'm competitive professionally.
Mm-hmm.
I want to win professionally.
Mm-hmm.
I can translate fighting to those terms.
Yes.
And I would think that you, having written for so many of the most important magazines in this country and having established yourself as being the guy, the go-to guy when it comes to a major profile of an important figure, that was a fight to get to the place where you were the one they called on.
It is a fight, and it's still a fight, and I'm not even sure I'm winning. I think it's, that's a different issue, but that particular business of magazine journalism is in eclipse, and it was hard when I got into it, and it's just gotten harder.
Let's take a break right now. When we come back, more with Steve Oney, author of A Man's World. If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Oney. In a career spanning some 40 years, he's written profiles of movie stars, athletes, rock and roll icons, and others for magazines like Esquire, GQ, Playboy, and Time. He began his magazine career writing for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution magazine. His new book is A Man's World. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, Steve, is I want to talk about some of the profiles, and I really want to highlight some of the writing.
Well, thank you.
And the way in which you've organized your writing in these pieces. In the fighter section, the first piece, and a longer profile, is of Chris Leon, who had a troubled youth, as you tell us in the piece, and was able to find himself as a Marine, yes?
The piece is called The Casualty of War, and it's about a troubled young Angelino who nearly flunked out of high school, was selling and using meth, and straightened himself up at the 11th hour and joined the Marine Corps. And the Marine Corps saved his life and took him to his death. And he was killed in combat at age 20, shot by a sniper.
And your piece focuses on his parents and how they walked through that tragedy and tried to put their lives together in some way.
To me, one of the strange truisms of the Iraq and the Afghan war is that so many of us don't know anyone who's serving. And I realized that I didn't know anyone who'd been killed, so I got a list of the killed in action in Los Angeles. There were about 80 people at that time, and I called Chris Leon's family. It was the third or fourth phone call I made, and the dad picked up the phone, and Chris had been killed a couple months before, and it was as if the father had been waiting for me to phone him ever since he got the news. And I drove out to his house, and his wife was there, and we had an hour-long conversation, at the end of which Chris's mom pulled down the back of her sweater and showed me that she'd had Chris's face tattooed into her shoulder blade. And it was such an intimate, tragic thing to share with somebody. And I realized these people want to tell me their story. There aren't going to be many limits with these people. But nonetheless, I went back to Los Angeles and returned. They lived in the northern part of L.A. County, and I returned to their house the next Sunday and went to church with them without taking any notes. I just thought, that's a gesture of good faith. I'm going to show these people that I'm not a vulture. I'm here because I respect what they're going through. And then the next week, I started taking copious notes.
And the essay is very moving, and it does accomplish what you're talking about. It helps us, it puts real faces and real emotion into these casualties of war that we really don't quite understand. But it's what you chose to close it with. It's the quote that you choose as the closing piece. You quote his dad, Jim. "We've lost not just Chris, but our future," Jim says one late winter afternoon sitting in the den. "There will be no wedding, no grandchildren, no one to leave any of our possessions to. Ahead of us is nothing. It's just a hole." You knew when you heard him say that at some point in your conversations, didn't you, that that would have to be the way you'd end this piece?
Yes? I knew it would come near the end, but this is why you need a good editor. I wrote another couple of paragraphs after that, and my editor said, when I turned in the final draft, he said, you overshot the runway. Let's just stop it right here.
You're right. The editor helped you in that, because that ending is, from my point of view, chilling and complete.
Thank you. I think what that ending does is, what is loss? It's final. And it's an ending. And that piece is about the extinguishing of a 20-year-old's life. It's over. It's over for everyone. And yet, I think Chris Leon had a very successful life. I admire him a lot. I think he straightened himself out. I think his service in the Marine Corps was admirable. He was a great Marine. And I spoke to everyone. I spoke to his captain, his major, everyone associated with him. He was a corporal, but they were all completely taken with him and devastated by his death. And that goes to the larger point about fighting. Chris was in a bad place as a sophomore in high school. He was on his way to drug addiction, arrest, at the best, but he fought his way out of it. He had to fight and confront some real issues. So that's what I mean by fighting.
He
fought his way out of a bad place into a good place. Now, unfortunately, he died, but you know, we're all going to die, and he died, as far as I'm concerned, in a very noble manner.
You have, in your essay, Hollywood Fixer, which you wrote for Playboy in 2010, I was struck by the lead. We all work hard. At anybody who's been a print journalist, whether it's short form or long form, understands how important it is to find the right lead. And I couldn't help but think, this was a great lead. Do you mind if I read it to you?
Please, please. I liked it, too.
When Kate Moss, just arrived from London, emerges from the Tom Bradley terminal at Los Angeles International Airport, the paparazzi swarm, 30, maybe 40 in number. They will do almost anything to get a shot of the model. All that stands between their two-foot lenses and her multi-million-dollar face is Aaron Cohen. That's a great lead.
Thank you.
Who's Aaron Cohen?
Aaron Cohen runs a personal security firm in Los Angeles, and he protects stars, and he does a lot of other stuff, but that's the main thing he does. And he's a Jewish kid from Beverly Hills who, when he graduated from Beverly Hills High, instead of going off to a fancy college, got a one-way ticket, flew to Israel, joined the Army, and because he's a very talented and smart guy, was recruited to be in the Israeli Special Services, and he acquired some exceptionally lethal skills in that position, which made him highly marketable when he came back to Los Angeles. And, you know, we think celebrities, you know, they're spoiled rotten. They are spoiled rotten, and they have multi-million-dollar apparatuses just to prop up their ego, but they are also in danger, and there are stalkers, and the paparazzi are the least of it. And Aaron Cohen has found a niche for himself, providing security against stalkers and the kind of people who prey on celebrities. And luckily for me, the lead to that piece, I wrote near the end of the article, but someone in Aaron's entourage had taken cell phone video of this whole encounter with Kate Moss at the Tom Bradley terminal. So I had, you know, Aaron had told me about it, but then I could watch it. And I just sort of described what I saw. And Aaron is now branched out into a bigger security arena. You see him on CNN and Fox talking about terrorism and protecting sites against terrorist attacks.
It's a really interesting essay. People should read it because his career has been fascinating. He comes into contact with some of the world's greatest celebrities. He has interesting techniques that you describe for various ways that he keeps track and protects them. So he's another example of a fighter.
Yeah, he's a fighter, and he's, strangely enough, he's completely non-confrontational. His whole method is to avoid conflict. So he tries to think out whatever the potential pitfalls his clients might face, address them intellectually before they could even happen, and nothing does happen. When he's protecting somebody, I mean, yes, he was out front walking Kate Moss through that crowd of paparazzi, but usually you never even see him.
Yeah. You have a section of the book on creators, because in talking about the things that you've learned profiling men, aside from fighting, you've said they must create. And I think in your essay on Robert Penn Warren, the great poet, novelist, it really is an extraordinary example of a great creative force in American culture.
Mr. Warren was a hero to me, and I read All the King's Men when I was going to summer school in 1973 at the University of Georgia, and I convinced the Atlanta Journal and Constitution magazine to fly me up to Vermont, where Warren had his summer home, and I spent a week with Mr. Warren and his wife, the equally creative Eleanor Clark, who was a National Book Award winner for her nonfiction book about oyster farming and oyster harvesting in France. And I was ecstatic about the week. I was very nervous because I admired him so much, but he put me at ease. And I stayed in a little hotel down the valley from where he lived and would show up at his house each morning about 9 o'clock, and we would talk for a couple of hours and then take a hike into the woods, and then we would have dinner and drinks with his wife and whoever happened to be gathering. So it was a magical week with one of the giants who really invented Southern literature. And you know, through him, I could reach back to all the greats of the Vanderbilt Fugitives, John Crow Ransom and Alan Tate.
That was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about in terms of him. Tell us about his academic history. He went to Vanderbilt. Where did Warren grow up?
Warren grew up in Clarksville, Tennessee, okay, which is on the Tennessee-Kentucky line.
So he ended up at Vanderbilt, and I had never heard until I read your piece anything about the Fugitives at Vanderbilt University, part of a group of young intellectuals. Their quote was, "The fugitive flees from nothing faster than the high caste Brahmins of the Old South." And John Crow Ransom was sort of their leader, yeah?
He was their leader. He was writing publishable poetry. Everybody else was younger, although the Fugitives were college students. They were merchants in Nashville, and they met every week and read poetry and critiqued their own poetry. And they were intellectually cutthroat, but personally quite kind to one another. And it was like a book group where instead of reading texts by other authors, you were reading your own text to other writers and then vigorously critiquing them. And it was competitive, and it's how they all learned how to write.
But you tell us that this was one of the most, I don't remember the language you used, but this was an exceptional group, one of the finest literary groups in the country.
Yes, and all sorts of afterlife. There was a man named Andrew Lytle who was in the group and who only recently died, taught at the University of the South in Suwannee. I think he died in 2006 or 2007, but he was Flannery O'Connor's tutor and really helped Flannery O'Connor when she was first coming along. He was also, at a certain point, on the faculty at the University of Florida, and he was Harry Cruz's teacher when Harry Cruz was a student at the University of Florida. So you can really trace what happened in Nashville in the 1920s to what's happening today in Southern literature, because there are now a number of very fine writers who worked with someone like Harry Cruz. For instance, the suspense novelist Michael Conley. He was Harry Cruz's student at the University of Florida. So what happened in Nashville keeps on giving. I think it'd make a great book, actually. They were not politically correct. They were conservative, but they were of their time and of their place, and they were personally very generous.
You write about you got to observe the Warren marriage up close, and it is an interesting story. You say that Eleanor Clark, her marriage to Warren is one of sweet collaboration wed to a propensity for ceaseless oratorical battle. They disagreed on politics, people, literature, psychology, and economics. She's the liberal Eastern aristocrat. He's the clodhopper scholar with dung on his boots and poetry in his heart. And you describe a scene at the dinner table where they get into an argument about the Roosevelt family. Describe the battle and then the aftermath once your piece was published.
I was witness to an incredible back and forth about Franklin Roosevelt. It was high rhetoric, high japery, and Eleanor Clark had been a Marxist, and she was extremely liberal. Robert Penn Warren was conservative, and he also had a lot of devilry in him, so he liked to poke her about her liberal opinions. But he started in on Franklin Roosevelt and said, the thing you need to understand about Franklin Roosevelt, and Eleanor Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, had told Warren this, is that Mr. President Roosevelt was crippled, and he wanted all Americans to be crippled and to have someone to push him around. And Warren said this to his wife, knowing he was going to set her off, and he did. And they fought back and forth for about 20 minutes, and it was good-humored, but there was an edge to it where you sense that they might fall off the edge at any moment. But they kept pulling back, pushing further, pulling back, and I had taken a tape recorder with me, and I had the tape recorder running, so I have a verbatim transcript of this back and forth, and I used it in the piece, and I think it's funny, and I think it's dear, and I think its rhetoric is such high quality that you would never hear this kind of talk around most American dining tables, because most Americans aren't smart enough to speak so literally. I'm certainly not, and so I wrote it up in the middle of the piece, because I thought it was so revealing. And after my piece came out, Mr. Warren sent me a 4-page single space type letter that he began by saying, you know, Eleanor and I are so grateful to know you. We consider you a new friend, and we hope you'll feel free to call on us and visit us anytime you're near, because we want you to be a part of our lives. And I never saw Mr. Warren again, but he was good to his word. He and I stayed in touch through letters and postcards for the next 10 years, the last 10 years of his life. But he then added, but I think you've made a couple factual mistakes in the piece, and they were minor mistakes that I corrected. I had somebody's age wrong, and some of them were anachronisms. He used to run a lot to get himself into a zone where he could write his poetry. And I was writing this piece in the 70s, and I wrote that he jogged. And, you know, he corrected me and said, you know, we did not jog in the 20s. We ran. And but then he took me to task for the section about Roosevelt. And he thought I'd slightly invaded his privacy by recording that. But he didn't say you shouldn't have done it. What he really did was he realized that he was the subject and I was the author. And so he pushed back at me, but he didn't say, you shouldn't have done it. He just said, I'm a little sorry you did it.
At the end of your piece, can I?
Sure.
I'm reading your words.
Well,
I hope you're
you.
Okay
I love
with that.
That's why I'm here.
Late one afternoon, as occasional gusts of wind blew out of the mountains, bringing slight respite from the heat, Warren sat on his front porch facing a visitor. The room was aglow in the roseate hues of a fading day. Ensconced in a comfortable rocking chair, his eagle-beaked, strong-boned, ruddy old face twisted into a frown, he answered the visitor's questions. Except for their voices, there was no sound. And then you ask him the key question. Are you sad about getting old? It's a beautiful moment to set up that question.
Thank you. And he was sad about getting old. And he was experiencing what we all experience. And it's a great tragedy. And I'm now 62 and I'm starting to experience it. My friends are dying. He went on to talk very poignantly about one of his best friends, the great novelist Catherine Ann Porter, who was then in her mid-80s, and she was dying. And he spoke very lovingly of her, almost as if they were lovers, but he was quick to interject, we were never lovers, but there was something between us, and now that I see her being extinguished, now that I see there's going to be, to use the phrase I used in the Chris Leon piece, this hole in my life, I am deeply, deeply sad. And that's one of the hard things about getting old?
You know, that's a question that I have thought I should ask virtually everyone who comes in to be a guest on Two Way Street. How does it feel to be getting older? Because it is one of the most fundamental questions. I'm now 70. It's one of the most fundamental and most shattering kind of moments that you contend with getting old.
It's just hard. I mean, there's the, the alternative is worse. And the, on some level, I think, as you were telling me before we began taping, you can get better. Your mind gets sharper. You're in more control of your work. If you have good health, you can be incredibly productive. And I think it's the sense of loss. And you look at pictures of yourself from your 20s and you think, who is that person? That I'm not that person anymore. And that's just a blow to your ego, if nothing else. And then, you know, you lose your friends and you lose, and the world goes on without you. The world becomes something. I mean, we're living in this time of extraordinarily rapid change because of technology. And the world I grew into as a 22-year-old working at the Atlanta newspapers doesn't exist anymore because of technological change.
We're going to take another break right now. More with Steve Oney when we return. This is Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm talking to magazine writer Steve Oney about his new book, A Man's World. It's a collection of 20 profiles of men that Oney has written about over almost four decades for magazines like Playboy, Esquire, GQ, and many others. I want to take a quick stroll through a few other of your essays, if I may. There are a number of Atlanta people featured in here. In 1987, Esquire published your profile of John Portman. And we don't have to, John Portman, the great builder of downtown Atlanta, of downtown Detroit. You and I could sit here and probably have a really healthy argument about how I believe John Portman destroyed downtown Atlanta. But in reading your essays, you seem to have a lot of admiration for it. Let's not even go there. You know what I want to talk about with the Portman essay, I believe. His hair.
Yes, I opened my profile of John Portman with an extended description of his hairdo. He has probably the most outrageous comb-over in Christendom, and it begins as a salty brown swell coming off the edge of his head, and he's not content merely to sweep it over his bald spot. It's arranged into a sculpture. It's as if he's wearing an Alexander sculpture on his head, and it has motion and fluidity, and it's really I don't know how long it takes him each morning to do it, but people thought in my paragraph about this that I was being mean, but I wasn't being mean because I had this burst of insight that John Portman wears his design philosophy right atop his head. It's outrageous and defensive at the same time, and when you go into downtown Atlanta and you see all these buildings that John Portman designed that are closed off from the street, that's the defensive part. And yet, when you see the Polaris Lounge and the extraordinary playful gestures that Portman makes on his interiors, Those are the outrageous parts
you just,
of his style.
Here's what you say about his hair. It's an outrageously conceived, meticulously arranged wave that takes off from one fringe of his balding pate like a tsunami and surfs across his skull, breaking and rising in salty brown swells until it crashes over his opposite ear. It's hard for me to even say that without starting to laugh. He did not like that.
He did not like it. Well, you know, none of us... Here's a basic rule of life. Forget about fighting and acting. Just don't mess with somebody's hair. Don't mess with their hair.
I want to talk about, again, I think a wonderful way in which you set up an essay about someone who's just passed away. Greg Allman, as we all know, just died within the past few weeks. And you profiled him for Esquire in 1984, and you connected with Allman at a time when his life was not going well. He was heavily into drugs. His musical life had kind of collapsed around him. And here's what's wonderful to me about that. You're on the tour bus with Greg Allman. He's at a low point in his career. The band is on the outskirts of New York City. And as they're heading east, they tell a story that conjures up a time that he played Madison Square Garden.
Right. Greg starts talking about walking into Madison Square Garden and hearing the roar of the crowd and going up onto the stage. And his brother Dwayne is right in front of him, and light is coming over Greg's beautiful wood Hammond organ. And it's a dream. It's actually a dream he'd had even as a kid. And here it was being realized. And he's just finished sharing this memory with the other band members who are sitting with me at the front of the bus.
But then you say, but that was long ago, when New York draws so tantalizingly close that Allman can almost reach out and touch it, the bus veers west onto another highway. That is a remarkable way to set up the career path that he was on at the point that you encountered him. There's New York, but it's no longer his.
He was headed to play a date in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Five-member band. They're getting $5,000 for the date, out of which they got to pay their hotel rooms, their manager, the roadies. So maybe he's making $750, $500 for that night's work. And this was a guy who, at the peak of his career in the Allman Brothers, was making $300,000 or more a night. So he was at rock bottom. He was playing Holiday Inn lounges. And I followed him around for a week on the East Coast, and almost everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Equipment failures, bandmates getting sick. And then I hooked up with him at the end of the tour. He was in Los Angeles, and I was with him when he did a guest appearance on Thick of the Night, which was Alan Thicke's talk show. And Alan Thicke was an incredibly nice guy who also just recently died. But it was a struggling show. It was the only show that ever really got a zero in the Nielsen ratings. It was at the rock bottom. And Greg was, among the other guests, was a psychic named Kenny Kingston, who was trying to communicate with the spirit of Marilyn Monroe via what he said was one of her fingernails. It was, you know, this was late night television happening in prime time, and there was Greg. And after he talks to Thicke and the band plays a song, he goes back to a seedy hotel, and he's alcoholic, he's in AA, he's trying not to drink, he's drinking a little bit, but he's trying not to. He orders a big jug of iced tea, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and he falls into his bed and just says, I'm beat. That's the end of the piece. I'm beat.
But you end up, you had great admiration for his spirit. He did not give up.
Yeah, Greg didn't, he was not beat. That was the irony. He went on to a 30-plus year career as a solo artist. His gigs at the Beacon Theater on the West Side in New York, he had a 12 or 15 year standing date there, and he's got a new album coming out produced by Don Was. There's a piece on him in the new issue of Rolling Stone by Michael Gilmore that I haven't read yet, but it's a piece that kind of picks up where my piece ends. It's about the incredible second act in Greg Allman's life. And Greg Allman, he had guts. He had some stick-to-itiveness, and he was dealt a very bad hand and played through it and had a productive second act in his life.
All right, we've only got a few minutes left. There are so many essays in here that we could talk about, but of course you would prefer it if people would buy the book and read it, and I understand that. But let's talk about it. Can we do a little quick back and forth? Every interviewer undoubtedly says, who is your favorite interview? I will not go there because that would be ridiculous. So I'm going to try a few other things. Funniest interview.
Tracy Ullman, a piece I did on her for GQ. It's not in the book.
Smartest interview.
Robert Penn Warren.
Yeah. Most beautiful.
Anne Margaret, a piece I did for the New York Times Arts and Leisure section. I sat with her on her porch in her Beverly Hills house late in the evening. The porch was lit only by votive candles. She was about 50 years old and was stunning, even at 50. And she was wearing some sort of aquamarine wrap that was so such a great contrast to her reddish hair and milky complexion. And we talked. She had a new dance show that was going to Radio City Music Hall. And we talked about that show, and we talked about the dance numbers with Elvis and Viva Las Vegas.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was very close to every man's fantasy.
The person it was hardest for you to tear yourself away from when the work was finished?
I adored this guy, Brandon Tartikoff, who was the president of NBC Television.
You became friends,
didn't
you?
We became friends. The thing about writing magazine pieces is you make very few friends and you make very few enemies. They're transactions. But I actually became quite friendly with Brandon. And he was a good weekend softball player, and we played softball together for the next 10 years.
Here's how you close your book. If the whole book is about essays of men and you've tried to learn more about life as you went through your stories with them, you say this: the solution is to face whatever it is. You can't run. It's always out there. The correct move is to confront the darkness, even if you have to seek it. That's what Harry Cruz advised in the earliest story in this collection, written in 1977 when I was a kid. Here I was in my 50s, coming back around to the same issue. It never ends. Fighting, creating, acting, embracing danger. These are the things I had to teach myself.
I hope that's a fair summation.
Well, Steve, it's been a real joy to be able to talk to you. The book is A Man's World, Portraits, a Gallery of Fighters, Creators, Actors, and Desperados. And welcome home, brother.
Hey, thank you, Bill. Or since we're on the radio, welcome south, brother.
That's what I should have said.
This is a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
Steve Oney's book features 20 of the profiles he's written over his long career. There are articles about movie stars Harrison Ford and Nick Nolte, about the famously wild writer Harry Cruz, about former Atlanta Hawk coach and TV commentator Hubie Brown, and the now-deceased right-wing provocateur Andrew Breitbart, who Steve knew when they were both members of a Hollywood writers group that meant to talk about politics and current events long before Breitbart started his website. And there are many more. You'll find information about the book on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. Finally, while Steve has made his career as a magazine writer, in 2004 he published a book that brought him back home to Atlanta. And The Dead Shall Rise is his critically acclaimed nonfiction book about the Leo Frank case. Frank was the Atlanta businessman accused of murdering 13-year-old Mary Fagan, a Marietta girl who worked in the pencil factory that Frank managed. Frank was subsequently abducted from the state prison and lynched in Marietta. Steve worked on And the Dead Shall Rise for more than 17 years before he was satisfied he'd plumbed the depths of every detail of the infamous case. Along the way, he uncovered important new information, including the names of the respected business leaders and politicians who were in the lynching party. It's a powerful work set in the city where Steve came of age. So we've put information about End the Dead Shall Rise on our website, too. That's about all the time we have for this week's show. Remember, if you're not near a radio when we're on the air, you can subscribe to the Two Way Street podcast on iClouds or wherever you get your podcasts. And all of our shows are archived on the website at gpb.org/TWS. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Jenny edited this week's show. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold, and our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.